Well, good evening. My name is Jonathan Jeffrey, and I'm a librarian at Western, and have the distinct privilege of being able to introduce our guest tonight for our one book discussion. Now, many of you are aware that we have a piece of sculpture down on Fountain Square Park called The Classics, and it's on the Main Street side, and it's by a very well-known and popular sculptor, George Washington Lundeen, out of Loveland, Colorado. And it features three children. And one of them is obviously older because he's bigger. And he is holding a very large book, and on the outside of it, it's titled The Classics. And the other two children, a boy and a girl, are looking on to the book. And one day as I was passing by, I noticed that a family group was there having their portrait made with the sculpture. And I also noticed that one of the group members had Down syndrome, one of the girl members. And that wasn't all that unusual, but being a librarian, I just thought it was great that they were taking a photograph with a piece of sculpture that was about reading. I was on top of it for that. But as I came back through the park after returning on my errand, I saw a friend of mine, and I was relaying this story about this photograph that had been taken. And when I mentioned that one of the children had Down syndrome, you know those moments when you see a light bulb over someone's head? Well, there was that light bulb, and she said, "Come with me." And she took me over to the sculpture, and she said, "I want you to examine this piece of sculpture very carefully." Obviously, she was a teacher, right? And I'm into cultural analysis, so I knew exactly what she was doing. So I looked at the sculpture very carefully, and it didn't take me very long to see that the large child, the older one, had Down syndrome. Now, I have a saying for such moments. You're ignorant until you're informed. Now, that's very simple, but when you think about it, there's a lot of truth in it. And I thank Kim Edwards for not only writing a provocative, well-written book, but for informing us about a topic about which many of us remain ignorant. And I'm not just talking about Down syndrome here. Although that's a topic worthy of education. Instead, I'm referring to the concept that the actions and decisions that we make have consequences. And too many people today are blissfully ignorant of that. And these decisions also affect the people around us. And when David Henry, in effect, played God on that snowy day in March 1964, when he effectively aborted Phoebe's life from his family, his action created grave consequences for that family unit. Kim Edwards is a native of Texas, and although she spent most of her formative years in New York State, she has a degree from Colgate University and is a graduate of the Iowa Writers Workshop. Her book of short stories entitled The Secrets of a Fire King was an alternate for the 1998 Penn Hemingway Award and garnered several other writing awards. And her novel, Memory Keeper's Daughter, which we're going to discuss this evening, has been on the New York Times bestseller list for over 7 months. And she was a recipient, I'm proud to say, of the 2005 Kentucky Literary Award for Fiction, which is presented by our very own Southern Kentucky Book Fest and its partners. Kim?
Thank you for that very nice introduction, and thanks to everyone involved in this wonderful event. It's great to be back in Bowling Green. This is my second trip here, and wonderful to be here for the One Campus, One Community, One Book event. I think it's just a splendid way to celebrate reading, and I'm delighted to be here. I'm going to read a little bit from The Memory Keeper's Daughter tonight, and then I'm going to open things up to questions. And I guess I wanted to say two things about questions. First of all, that's always my favorite part of the evening. So I really encourage you to ask any questions that you have on your mind. Don't hesitate. Don't be shy. I've heard a wide range of views about The Memory Keeper's Daughter. I've heard a lot of different opinions. I spent a lot of time traveling last summer, and so I've heard a lot of different things, and nothing will surprise me, but invariably something does surprise me. That's always the wonderful part. Somebody always asks something that I have never thought about before. So please don't hesitate to ask. I would also ask you, though, when you're framing your questions, and when I talk tonight, I'm going to try not to talk about the end of the book or to give away anything that has happened, because I've met a lot of people today who have gotten halfway through the book or a third of the way through the book and who don't know what happens next. So I don't want to spoil the ending for them. And I've had that happen a couple times when I've been giving readings where either I or somebody in the audience has said something and everybody gets a little bit dismayed because they don't want to know, they want to read it. The Memory Keeper's Daughter starts in 1964 in Lexington, Kentucky, where I've lived for the last 10 years. I did a lot of research about Lexington to figure out what life was like there at that time. Had a good time reading the Herald and the Leader in the microfiche room at the library. And it begins on a snowy night in 1964 when Dr. David Henry delivers his own twins in a snowstorm, a big snowstorm. And when his children are born, he sees at once that his son, Paul, is perfectly healthy, but he sees also that his daughter, Phoebe, has Down syndrome. And at that time in 1964, it was a very commonly accepted attitude in the medical community, but also I think in the culture at large, that children with Down syndrome or other kinds of mental challenges should be institutionalized. It was pretty typical that that happened. And so David Henry makes this sort of impulsive decision based or as a response to that or informed by that sort of general climate or general way of thinking. He asks his nurse to take the baby to an institution, and when his wife Nora wakes up from the sedation, he tells her that the baby died, that the twin died. And so that sets the novel in motion, that those events happen in the first chapter. And the novel follows the Henry family for 25 years with this secret in the center of it, and it follows also the nurse, Carolyn, who cannot take the baby to the institution, who tries to but cannot leave her there, and who instead, for some reasons of her own, as well as a sense of altruism, flees to Pittsburgh and raises Phoebe there as her own. When I started The Memory Keeper's Daughter, I did not know anything about Down syndrome. I did a lot of research about Down syndrome to try to educate myself because I didn't know anything. And in fact, I didn't start writing the book for several years because I just didn't feel as if this was a challenge that I could take on to write about a character who had Down syndrome and to do it realistically without being sentimentalizing, without sentimentalizing her or being patronizing. I was very concerned about the presentation of Phoebe. So I did a tremendous amount of research, reading first, and then I started talking to people, and I met with wonderful families all across the country, all in Lexington first, to talk about, who shared their stories about raising their children during this era and during the contemporary era. I didn't use any of the stories that were given to me in those wonderful exchanges, but I did come to understand the landscape the families had faced. And it's been a wonderful experience for me now that the book is out in the world, that it has been well received by families who have a loved one with Down syndrome. In fact, the bracelet that I'm wearing tonight, I wanted to show you. I really treasure this. This is made by the National Down Syndrome Society, and it has 20 beads, 20 little white beads like this. Those represent the 20 chromosomes that we all have. And then this extra bead in the center is for the 21st chromosome that Down syndrome people have. And I just thought that was the most beautiful concept, and I really treasure it. So I'm going to read tonight from the part, I'll read for about 15 minutes and then open it up to questions. But I'm going to read about the part where Carolyn has gone to Pittsburgh, and it's in the early days of her life there, and where she, too, is trying to figure out how to best be a mother to Phoebe, how to understand what will help Phoebe the most. And it's in the early days of her time there. And she's met another woman named Sandra, who has a child with Down syndrome. They met at the library. That's one of the reasons that I chose it. It's so good to be here at the library, in this wonderful library. And so this is the scene. Sandra is standing on the porch, and when Caroline opened the door, she burst in, holding Tim by one hand and hauling a big cloth bag in the other. She was a tall, large-boned, blonde, and forceful woman. She sat down without ceremony in the middle of the rug, dumping the stacking toys in a pile. "Sorry I'm so late," she said. "The traffic's awful out there. Doesn't it just drive you crazy, living this close to the crosstown? It would drive me nuts." Anyway, check out what I found. Look at these great stacking toys. Plastic, different colors. Tim loves them. Carolyn sat down on the floor, too. Like Dora, the woman who owns a house where Carolyn is living, Sandra was an unlikely friend, someone Carolyn would never have known in her old life. They'd met in the library one bleak January day when Carolyn, overwhelmed by experts and grim statistics, had slammed a book shut in despair. Sandra, two tables over amid her own stack of books, the spines and covers terribly familiar to Carolyn, looked up. "Oh, I know just how you feel," she said. "I'm so angry I could break a window." They'd begun to talk then, cautiously at first, then in a rush. Sandra's son, Tim, was nearly 4. He had Down syndrome too, but Sandra hadn't known it. That he was slower to develop than her other 3 children, this she had noticed. But to Sandra, slow was only slow and no excuse for anything. A busy mother, she'd simply expected Tim to do what her other children had done, and if it took him longer, that was all right. He'd been walking by the time he was 2, toilet trained by age 3. The diagnosis had shocked her family, and the doctor's suggestion that Tim should be put into an institution had angered her into action. Carolyn had listened intently, her heart lifting with every word. They left the library and went for coffee. Carolyn would never forget those hours, the excitement she'd felt, as if she were waking from a long, slow dream. What would happen, they conjectured, if they simply went on assuming their children would do everything? Perhaps not quickly, perhaps not by the book. But what if they simply erased those growth and development charts with their precise constricting points and curves? What if they kept their expectations but erased the timeline? What harm could it do? Why not try? Yes, why not? They'd begun to meet here or at Sandra's house with her older, rambunctious boys. They brought books and toys, research and stories, and their own experiences. Carolyn's as a nurse, Sandra's as a schoolteacher, and a mother of 4. A lot of it was simple common sense. If Phoebe needed to learn to roll over, well, put a bright ball, just out of her reach. If Tim needed to work on coordination, then give him blunt scissors and bright paper and let him cut. The progress was slow and sometimes invisible, but for Carolyn, these hours had become a lifeline. "You look tired today," Sandra said. Carolyn nodded. "Phoebe had croup last night. I don't know how long she'll hold out this morning, actually. Any news about Tim's ears?" "I like the new doctor," Sandra said, sitting back. Her fingers were long and blunt. She smiled at Tim and handed him a yellow cup. "He seemed compassionate, this doctor. He didn't just dismiss us. But the news isn't great. Tim has some hearing loss, so that's probably why his speech has been so slow. Here, sweetie," she added, tapping the cup he dropped, "show Miss Caroline and Phoebe what you can do." But Tim was not interested. The nap of the carpet had his attention, and he ran his hands through it again and again, fascinated and delighted. Sandra was firm, however, calm and determined, and finally he took the yellow cup, pressed its edge to his cheek for a moment, then put it on the floor and started stacking others in a tower. For the next 2 hours, they played with their children and talked. Sandra had strong opinions about everything and was not afraid to speak her mind. Carolyn loved sitting in the living room and talking with this smart, bold woman, mother to mother. These days, Carolyn often longed for her own mother, dead almost 10 years now, wishing she could call her up and ask advice or simply stop by to see her hold Phoebe in her arms. Had her mother felt all this, the love and the frustration, as Carolyn grew up? She must have. And suddenly Carolyn understood her childhood differently. The constant worry about polio, that, in its own strange way, was love. And her father's hard work, his careful concentration on their finances at night, that was love as well. She did not have her mother, but she had Sandra, and their mornings together were a highlight of her week. They told stories from their lives, shared ideas and suggestions about parenting, laughed together as Tim tried to stack the cups on their heads, as Phoebe reached and reached for a sparkly ball, and finally, despite herself, rolled over. Several times that morning, Carolyn, still worried, dangled her car keys in front of Phoebe. They flashed, catching in the morning light, and Phoebe's small hands flew open, her fingers waving, splayed like a starfish. Music, motes of light, she reached for the keys as well. But no matter how she tried, she could not catch them. "Next time," Sandra said. "Wait and see. It'll happen." At noon, Carolyn helped them carry their things to the car, and then she stood on the porch with Phoebe in her arms, tired already, but happy too, waving as Sandra pulled her station wagon out into the street. When she went inside, Leo, who's the old man that she's taking care of, Leo's records was skipping, playing the same 3 bars over and over again. "Ornery old man," she thought, starting up the stairs. "Couldn't you turn that down?" she began, exasperated, pushing open the door. But the record was skipping in an empty room. Leo was gone. Phoebe began to cry as if she had some sort of internal barometer for strife and tension. Leo must have slipped out the back when Carolyn was helping Sandra. Oh, he was clever, even though these days sometimes he left his shoes in the refrigerator. He took great pleasure in tricking her like this. Three times before, Leo had slipped away, once stark naked. Carolyn hurried down the stairs and shoved her feet into a pair of Doro's loafers, a size too small and cold. A coat for Phoebe, nestled in the stroller. For herself, she'd go without. The day had turned overcast with low gray clouds. Phoebe whimpered, her small hands flailing as they walked past the garage to the alley. "I know," Carolyn murmured, touching her head. "I know, sweetheart, I know." She spotted one of Leo's footprints in a melting crust of snow, the large, waffled sole of his boots, and felt a rush of relief. He'd come this way, then, and he was dressed. Well, at least he had his boots on. At the end of the next block, she came to the 105 steps that led down to the Koning Field. It was Leo who had told her how many steps there were, one night over supper when he was in a civil mood. Now he was at the bottom of the long cement cascade, his hands hanging at his sides, his white hair sticking out, looking so puzzled, so lost, and so distressed that her anger dissolved. Carolyn did not like Leo March. He was not a likable man. But whatever animosity she held for him was complicated by compassion. For in moments like these, she saw how the world looked at him and saw an old man, senile and forgetful, rather than the universe that had been, that was still, Leo March. He turned and saw her, and after a moment, his confusion cleared from his face. "Watch this," he shouted. "Watch this woman and weep." Quickly, oblivious to the ice, a stilled stream down the middle of the steps, Leo ran up to her, his legs pumping, fueled by some ancient adrenaline. "I'll bet you never saw anything like that," he said, reaching the top, winded. "You're right," Carolyn said. "I never did, and I hope I never do again." Leo laughed, his lips a vivid pink against his bleached pale skin. "I got away from you," he said. "You didn't get far. I could, though, if I had a mind. Next time." "Next time, take a coat," Carolyn advised. "Next time," he said as they started walking, "I'll disappear in Timbuktu." "You do that," Carolyn said, a tide of weariness rushing in. Crocuses shouted purple and white against the bright grass. Phoebe was crying in earnest now. Carolyn was relieved to have Leo in tow, to have found him safe, grateful that disaster had been averted. Her fault if he'd been lost or hurt, because she'd been so focused on Phoebe, who'd reached for weeks now and had still not learned to grasp. They walked for a few more feet in silence. "You're a smart woman," Leo said. She stopped on the bricks, astonished. "What? What did you say?" He looked at her, lucid, his eyes the same bright, seeking blue as Doro's. "I said you're smart. My daughter hired 8 different nurses before you. None of them lasted more than a week. Bet you didn't know that." "No," Carolyn said. "No, I didn't." Later, as Carolyn cleaned up the kitchen and carried out the garbage, she thought of Leo's words. "I'm smart," she said to herself, standing in the alley by the trash can. The air was damp and cool. Her breath came out in tiny clouds. "Smart won't get you a husband," her mother said in sharp reply. But even this didn't dampen Carolyn's pleasure in the first nice words Leo had ever said to her. Carolyn stood for a moment longer in the chilly air, grateful for the silence. Garages staggered one after another down the hill. Gradually, she became aware of a figure standing at the base of the alley, a tall man in dark jeans and a brown jacket, colors so muted that he nearly became another part of the late winter landscape. Something about him, something about the way he stood and stared so intently in her direction, made Carolyn uneasy. She put the metal lid back on the garbage can and folded her arms across her chest. He was walking toward her now, a big man, broad shoulders and walking fast. His jacket was not brown at all, but a muted plaid with streaks of red. He pulled a bright red hat from his pocket and put it on. Carolyn felt oddly comforted by this gesture, though she didn't know why. "Hey there," he called. "That Fairlane running okay for you these days?" Her apprehension deepened, and she turned to look at the house, its dark brick rising into the white sky. Yes, there was her bathroom, where she had stood last night watching the moonlight on the lawn. There was her window, left partly open to the cold spring air, wind stirring the lacy curtains. When she turned back, the man had stopped just a few feet away. She knew him, and she understood this in her body, in her relief, before she could formulate it in thought. Then it was so bizarre she couldn't believe it. "How in the world?" she began. "It wasn't easy," Al said, laughing. He had grown a soft beard, and his teeth flashed white. His dark eyes were warm, pleased, and amused. She remembered him sliding bacon onto her plate, waving from the silver cab of his truck as he pulled away. "You are one tough lady to track down, but you said you might go to Pittsburgh, and I happen to have a layover here every couple of weeks. It kind of got to be a hobby, looking for you." He smiled. "I don't know what I'll do with myself now." Carolyn couldn't answer. There was pleasure at the sight of him, but a great confusion, too. For nearly a year, she had not let herself to think too long or too hard about the life she had left. But now it rose up with great force and intensity, the scent of cleaning fluid and sun in the waiting room, and the way it felt to come home to her tranquil, orderly apartment after a long day, to fix herself a modest meal, and to sit down for the evening with a book. She had given up those pleasures willingly. She had embraced this change out of some deep and unacknowledged yearning. Now her heart was pounding, and she stared wildly down the alley as if she might suddenly see David Henry there, too. This, she understood suddenly, was why she had never sent that letter to him. What if he wanted Phoebe back? Or Nora did. The possibility filled her with an excruciating rush of fear. "How did you do it?" Carolyn demanded. "How did you find me? Why?" Al, taken aback, shrugged. "I stopped in Lexington to say hello. Your place was empty, being painted. That neighbor of yours told me you'd been gone 3 weeks. I guess I don't like mysteries because I kept thinking of you." He paused, as if debating whether or not to go on. "Plus, well, I liked you, Carolyn, and I figured you were in some kind of trouble to cut out like you did. You sure had trouble written all over you, standing in the parking lot that day. I figured maybe I could lend you a hand. I figured maybe you might need it." "I'm doing just fine," she said. "So, what do you figure now?" She hadn't meant the words to come out as they did, tough and harsh. There was a long silence before Al spoke again. "I guess I figure I was wrong about some things," Al said. He shook his head. "I thought we hit it off, you and me." "We did," Carolyn said. I'm shocked, that's all. I thought I'd cut my ties." He looked at her then. His brown eyes met hers. "It took me a full year," he said. "If you're worried about someone else tracking you down, remember that. And I knew where to start, and I had good luck. I started checking the motels I knew, asking about a woman with a baby. Each time I went to a different place, and last week I hit pay dirt. The clerk at the place you stayed remembered you. She's retiring next week, by the way." He held his thumb and forefinger up, close together. "I came this close to missing you forever." Carolyn nodded, remembering the woman behind the hotel desk with her white hair in a careful beehive, pearl earrings glimmering. The motel had been in her family for 50 years. The heat rattled all night, and the walls were constantly damp, peeling paper. "You never knew anymore," the woman said, pushing a key across the counter. "Who was going to walk through the door?" Al nodded at Carolyn's powder blue Fairline. "I knew I'd found you the moment I saw that," he said. "How's your baby?" She remembered the empty parking lot a year before, all the light that had spilled onto the snow and faded, the way his hand had rested so gently on Phoebe's tiny forehead. "Do you want to come in?" she heard herself ask. "I was just about to wake her up. I'll make you some tea." Carolyn took him down the narrow sidewalk and up the steps to the back porch. She left him in the living room and climbed the stairs, feeling giddy, unsteady, as if she'd suddenly become aware that the planet beneath her turned in space, shifting her world, no matter how hard she tried to hold it still. She changed Phoebe and splashed water on her own face, trying to calm herself down. Al was sitting at the dining room table, looking out the window. When she came down the stairs, he turned, his face breaking into a wide grin. He reached for Phoebe at once, exclaiming over how big she'd grown, how beautiful she was. Carolyn felt a rush of pleasure, and Phoebe, delighted, laughed, her dark curls falling down around her cheeks. Al reached into his shirt and pulled out a medallion, clear plastic over gilded turquoise letters that said Grand Old Opry. He'd gotten it in Nashville. "Come with me," he had said to Carolyn all those long months ago, joking, and yet not joking. And here he was, having traveled all this way to find her. Phoebe was making soft sounds, reaching. Her hands were brushing against Al's neck, his collarbone, his dark plaid shirt. At first, it didn't register with Carolyn what was happening. Then, suddenly, it did. Whatever Al was saying receded, merging with Leo's footsteps upstairs and the rush of traffic outside, sounds that Carolyn would forever afterwards remember as being lucky. Phoebe was reaching for the medallion, not batting at the air as she had this morning, but using Al's chest for resistance, her small fingers scraping and scraping the medallion into her palm until she could close her fist around it. Rapt with success, she yanked the medallion hard on its string, making Al raise his hand to the chafing. Carolyn touched her own neck too, feeling the quick burn of joy. Oh yes, she thought, grab it, my darling, grab the world. Thank you. Thank you so much. I'd love to take questions. Someone has to be first. Yes?
I read where your minister told you the journal of the story. Could you elaborate on that?
Yeah, I moved to Lexington just over 10 years ago. And when I moved there, my husband and I, we had small children, and we found a small Presbyterian church right around the corner from our house. And we joined the church, and we had really interesting ministers, a couple who share the pastorship. They're both ordained ministers. And they both read my book that had just come out, my collection of stories called The Secrets of a Fire King. And for whatever reason, Claire, my pastor, stopped me one week and said, you know, I have a story. I read your book, and I really loved it. She said, and I have a story that I want to give to you. And so she told me the story of a man who was born, who discovered when he was in his 40s that he'd had a brother born with Down syndrome who had been institutionalized at birth, kept a secret from the family all his life, and had died in the institution unbeknownst to anyone. And that was what she told me. And I remember being very struck with that idea of the secret in the center of the family, and thinking that it would make a good novel, and thinking in the next heartbeat that I would never write that book. So, anyone else? Someone else, Shirley.
I would just like to say thank you for writing the book.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
A wonderful book, and it was very appropriate for this time frame where people are giving a lot of thought to whether or not to continue the pregnancy with Down syndrome.
Thank you. Yes, other questions?
Okay, I'll ask one.
Good. Oh, I'm so glad.
But I was just kind of, because I've lived in so many different places, why did you pick Pittsburgh and Morgantown, or West Virginia? Because those are both stomping grounds of mine.
Are they?
I do, too.
I lived in Pittsburgh. I spent 5 years living and teaching in Southeast Asia. My husband and I did that for years before we came back here, and he went to get his PhD at Pitt. So we lived in Pittsburgh for 4 years, and I really enjoyed it. And Lexington is obvious why I chose that. They're just cities that I felt I knew well enough to write about. And West Virginia, I had friends there and don't know it well, but passed through in various times to visit. So.
But my daughter gave me the book for Christmas, and when I read Forbes Avenue, we used to drive through Forbes Avenue. I grew up real close to Pittsburgh, and my husband went to WVU. So, yeah.
That's great. Yeah, I still have friends in Pittsburgh. Still go back. It's a great place. Yes.
Are you still writing? What's next?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the success of The Memory Keeper's Daughter has been phenomenal, but it's come at a point in my life where I've been writing seriously for 20 years. I think of it as a way of being more than anything else. It's what it's how I live in the world. And so it's wonderful to have this kind of sort of very visible success with a book, but I've always written, and I always will. Penguin is re-releasing my collection, The Secrets of a Fire King. It has three new stories in it. So that will happen this summer. And then before this hit the paperback and became such a phenomena, as they say, I was working on another novel already. And so I'm into it. I'm well into it. It's well begun, and I know I'll finish it, but I don't talk about them when they're at that early stage because it's a process of discovering the book, and I don't yet know it all to say it. And if I say too much about it, I'll kind of fix it in place, like David Henry with his photographs. So. Yes?
I think, like everybody, as you read, you visualize the characters, and the one thing I kept feeling as I was reading this, I was almost visualizing it as being a movie. Have you already been approached about this? Because I would think this is a book. I know you don't write for it to become a movie, but I certainly would see this as being one that would be very successful.
Yeah, it's true. I don't write with movies in mind. I don't even go to movies very much. Not because I don't like them, but it's just when my kids were small, I didn't go, and then I got out of the habit. But yes, it has been optioned for a television movie. I don't know more than that. That's sort of the early stages of it. Yes?
Were any of these characters based on real people that you
knew? Were any of the characters based on real people? No, they really aren't. I can never do that. I can never do justice to real people in fiction. So they weren't based on real people. They just, the characters sort of evolve as I write. I discover more about them as I work on the characters. And so I'll know something about them, and that will lead me to some other discovery about them. And then they become, I just get to know them better and better as I write. And then they start to do things that take me by surprise, which is always good, and always means that the book is coming to life, or the story is coming to life. Yes?
Does that mean that when you sit down to write a novel, this novel, you didn't have a clear plot line?
Exactly. I don't have a clear plot line. I don't plot them out. I told the initial idea of The Secret was told to me, and I thought I wouldn't write the book, and yet the idea stayed with me for about 3 years. And then, in a completely unrelated incident, I was invited to do a writing workshop with a group of adults who had mental challenges of various kinds. And I went and did the workshop. I'd never worked with that kind of, that population before. I didn't know what to expect, but I had a wonderful time with them. I just really enjoyed them. They wrote some beautiful things, and they were just very excited about writing, and we had a good time. We just had a good time. And that made me start to understand that maybe I could write this book, or would write this book. So when I finally got around to writing the first chapter, that came really quickly. It was almost like it was fully formed because it had been working itself out in my subconscious. I give a lot of credit to the power of the subconscious or the unconscious in any creative work. But that first chapter came very quickly. And then I was just intrigued. I didn't know what would happen. You know, what would Carolyn do? What would David do? How would this affect them for the rest of their lives? So I just started writing to try to find out. Yes.
Would you comment about the character of Rosemary?
Yeah.
Because you could have omitted Rosemary, but she added such a dimension.
See, I couldn't omit Rosemary. I felt, and I don't want to say too much because people might not have gotten there yet, but for me, Rosemary is an essential character. She comes later in the book, and I just felt like she was absolutely crucial. There's been a Barnes & Noble online discussion of the book the last month, which has been interesting to read, and several people have brought up Rosemary too, and they had various different kinds of feelings about why she was important, and it was interesting for me to read those. The ideas were that she was both reflected something about David's feelings for his daughter, or you know, represented some connection with the daughter, represented also a connection to his lost sister because he meets her in that house. She's the person to whom he's able to tell the secret finally and to unburden himself, and there's that connection too. So I feel like Rosemary is a really crucial character, someone I could never have done without in the book. So. Yes?
I was going to wanted to say that your writing style, I really love that because
thank
it's, I think it's, as all these questions everybody's been asking, I've been thinking of in my mind, but just it was so descriptive and just, you know, it was important to just read, just to have, you know, I don't know, phrase, but so I guess, and I think my question has already been answered. And I find it fascinating that when you started writing this novel, you did not know how it was going to end.
No idea.
It just kind of it evolved as you were writing it.
Yeah.
I just find that absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, it is fascinating. I mean, for me, that's the exciting thing about writing. And I think, you know, it's really true with any creative activity. And by that, I don't just mean, you know, the fine arts or writing or music. I mean, you know, any moment that you have in your life that's a creative moment, and we have them all the time. It's the same kind of thing like when you're puzzling about something in your life, you don't know what the answer is or what to do, and then suddenly you'll be taking a shower or taking a walk, and, you know, sort of without really realizing it, the answer, the thing that you need to do next sort of comes into your mind. It's that kind of moment when you write. It just you sort of leave yourself open to whatever happens next, whatever might happen next. Yes.
How long did it take you to write the book when you actually started writing it?
3 years, just about. Not a little bit over 3 years. And then it sold, and then I did probably 6 months, 9 months to a year of editing. I didn't edit all that time. I had to wait to hear from my editor for about 6 months, and then I did about 6 months of editing. So, yes?
This is a question we kind of bandied back and forth in the discussion group. Mm-hmm. Did David love Caroline? Look, there was so much emphasis on the look, that did he have feelings of affection for her? Was that...
What did you think in your group?
We didn't know. I mean, I think basically we thought that he did have feelings, but she didn't fit in with the mm-hmm. perfect family. She was older.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe so. I think David had some kind of feelings for her. I think also what's interesting to me about that moment is how it's significant for Carolyn and David in different ways. And so, you know, that sense, you know, sometimes we have that sense of sharing a moment with somebody that then turns out to be, you know, we're thinking about completely different things. So I think that certainly David understood her feelings for him. He intuited those, even though she never spoke them. And I think that... he's not a person who is much given to examining his feelings, was he? And so I think that probably whatever he felt for her remained sort of inside his own heart. Other thought? Yeah.
Could you tell us something about your experiences in the Iowa program?
Experiences in Iowa. Well, it was a long time ago. I lived next door to this great guy who became my husband. That was a good thing about Iowa. I went to the Iowa Writers' Workshop, and it was a terrific experience. I went, it wasn't always easy, but it was terrific. I went when I was very young. At that time, most of the people I was in school with had gone out and done interesting things. They'd been journalists, they traveled, they'd just done a lot of interesting things. And I hadn't. I had gone straight from undergraduate school to graduate school. So I learned really, really fast a lot of things about narrative structure and how to develop characters. And, you know, I feel like it was a time of great growth in that sense. But I also realized along the way that I didn't really know what I wanted to say. You know, I was only 22. I didn't have any earth-shattering things to share with the world. So in my second year there, I had the chance to teach composition. And in that class, there were half the students, maybe 10 students from other countries all over the place. Brazil and Hong Kong are the ones I remember. And they were fascinating, and I had always loved to travel. So I was beginning to realize that I wasn't going to publish for a while because I didn't have anything to say, no matter how beautifully I might say it, and that I would need to support myself. And so I got another degree in theoretical linguistics, which I joke is my practical degree, but actually I did get it for very practical. I did get it for very practical reasons, which is that with that degree you can go overseas and teach English as a second language, which is what I did. My husband and I got married, and then we went to Malaysia, and we lived on the rural east coast of Malaysia, and then Japan and Cambodia. And did that for 5 years. And it was during that time that I really learned how to use the tools I had been taught at Iowa. I had learned how to use those tools of craft, and I also discovered the stories that I wanted to tell. And that's when I really began to write work that would eventually go on to be published and become part of that collection, The Secrets of a Fire King. Other questions? Yes?
During your three-year process, did you ever have moments when you lost your faith in that story? Struggled with that, or were you struggling about it all the way through?
You know what? I had that kind of moment of crisis years before. I had been working between my story collection and this novel. I worked on another novel, and I just hit a brick wall with it about halfway through, and I just put it aside. And when I started this book, I just thought, you know what? One of the reasons I hit a brick wall with that previous book is that when the stories were published, I was urged by my publisher and other friends, with all good intentions, that since the stories were kind of set in exotic locations, I should pursue that in a novel. And I tried to write a novel that sort of carried on with the stories, not any specific story, but the sort of thematic and tonalities of the stories. And it wasn't what I needed to be writing. And so I kind of hit this brick wall, and I thought, well, you know, I could give up writing altogether. I don't have to write. No one cares if you don't write. And I could give it up, or I could just decide to go back and write for the reason that I started writing, which is that I love to do it. I just love to write. It's when I feel most alive. So when I started The Memory Keeper's Daughter, I thought, this time, I'm just going to I'm going to write for that reason. I'm going to write for the pure pleasure of it. I'm going to discover this book. And if I get to a point where I do get stuck and it's an insurmountable thing, then I'll stop. But I'm just going to do it as far as I can go because I love doing it. And I never did get stuck. Yes.
Now that this book has been such a success, does that influence your approach to writing future novels? I mean, do you now think about what might be pop good or what people want to read, or do you just are you able to continue to just write what you want to write, regardless of outside influences?
The latter. I mean, I don't worry about... I've been writing for 20 years, seriously, and I've learned over that time that you can't worry about what happens to a book when it goes out into the world because you cannot control it. Everybody would choose to have what happened to the memory keeper's daughter happen to their book. I would have chosen it for my first book. But you just can't... you can't control that. You just have no way of knowing what will happen. All you can do is write your next book and be true to the integrity of that book. And so I feel... like that's a lesson that I've learned, you know, sort of in many different ways, many different times, various kinds of situations over the last couple of decades of writing. So I am really excited about the next book. I don't really worry about what will happen to it next. Yes?
One of the things that amazed me when I read this book, I kept thinking, how could this happen? You know, how could something like this happen? And obviously it wouldn't. But when you did your research for this book, would it have been that easy to throw a child, basically, is what he did.
Yeah, it's amazing. But one of the things that happened is when I traveled... Well, first of all, the amazing thing that happened is the week before it was published in hardcover, The Memory Keeper's Daughter in hardcover, there was a National Public Radio story about a man who remembered that when he was 6 years old and his little sister was 3 years old, some of you may have heard this, his sister was 3 years old, she disappeared. His parents would never tell him what happened to her. And he never knew. He always asked, and he never knew. And his mother died years later, decades later, and then his father died. And when his father died, he found in his father's wallet a little card with an address on it. And he pursued the address, went to it, and found out it was the group home to which his sister had been sent at age 3 and where she had spent her whole life. And he finally met her. So, I mean, that's a true story. It was on NPR. And it was just the week before Memory Keeper's Daughter was published. But as I traveled around the country and talked to people, many, many times, people came up after meetings like this and they said, yeah, something like that happened in my family too. You know, the situation was such that it was possible and it did happen, more than we might accept.
Those children went to institutions, and I can see, you know, hiding them away. But then when Caroline actually took Phoebe and then raised her as her own, how was, you know, there was nothing ever... There were no questions asked.
She had the birth certificate. Dr. Henry had given her that to take her to the institution, had left it blank, so she filled that in. I mean, it's plausible, I think. Yes.
Did you always have it in your mind that he was going to be a photographer, or did that evolve also?
Kind of both. I mean, I sort of knew that about him from the very beginning, but it did also evolve. I really liked that imagery, and it seemed to fit his character so perfectly, you know, being caught in that moment. And the original title of the book was Capturing Light, dealing with that idea of photography and that idea of trying to contain what's not containable. Other questions? Yes?
I was just remembering what it was. The way you described once where he would start thinking of Phoebe or just thinking of his whole life and how painful it had become, and then he would divert himself by listing the... What was it? Some kind of scientific table.
Oh, the periodic table. Yeah, that's right.
I can relate to that. Mm-hmm. I didn't know that anybody else ever did that. lists that go through my mind, I just thought, oh my gosh, this guy's real.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Can you tell us about the last 6 months and how success has touched you personally and what your schedule has been like in the last 6 months?
Yeah, it's just been amazing and mostly just wonderful. You know, I can't say that there's really any downside having this happen. You know, The Memory Keeper's Daughter just took off last summer, and the summer was very busy. I traveled a tremendous amount all around the country. I had done a very small sort of book tour before it took off, and then Viking Penguin sent me a much longer one, which was fun. I guess For me, the most profound thing about it is that the success, people talk about bestseller lists, they talk about sales, but really each of those books is sold to a person. And for me, the most amazing thing has been that people have written to me, people from all over the world. I've had letters from New Zealand, letters from the Netherlands. The book hasn't been released in those countries yet, but they've found copies, people have found copies somehow. I had a letter from a friend in Malaysia saying, a good Malaysian friend who said that the book has hit the fourth on the bestseller list there. So somehow the book is just moving through the world and touching a lot of lives, and that's been the most incredible thing. It's been frustrating because I used to try to answer all the email that came in and answer all the letters, and I simply cannot do it anymore. I'm just completely overwhelmed. But it's also wonderful to have that kind of response and to know that the book has touched this kind of powerful chord, not just here, but really around the world. It's really an amazing thing. Anything else? Yes.
Do you feel like sharing personality characteristics with the characters in this book or your book?
Only the very best personality characteristics.
Of course.
I think that all characters I write, they're so diverse. You know, if you read the stories, you would know. But I think that to some extent for all writers, we don't write autobiography, but we write from our truest, most deeply held beliefs, I think. So I think, you know, obviously some of me is in every character.
Can you tell us a little bit about the discipline of your writing? Are you real regimented, or the free spirit when you write?
No, I'm not such a free spirit when I write. You know, I know I have a poet friend who said that he would just sit down and write on Sunday afternoons and hope that he felt inspired, which I thought was amazing. I try to write every day. I try to sit, you know, sort of clear a space in my mind and in my house and sit down and write, usually in the morning for 3 or 4 hours. I give it the first morning hours. It's the best time. And I work on a computer. I have for years. I started writing on a typewriter before computers, but for the last few years I've used computers and just have my morning coffee and see what happens.
You start at 4 o'clock like William Stafford used to?
I never started at 4, but when my children were young I used to get up and do it at 5 because they would still be asleep. They'd sleep till 9, so that was my time I could get. It was really nice. The moon would set and the sun would rise, and it was really pure, something really beautiful and pure about that time. Yes.
I'm just personally curious. I'm from the Lexington area. As I was reading that book, I was trying to figure out where that institution is. Where is that institution?
That institution doesn't exist. I'm glad you said that.
I kept thinking, you know,
no. I didn't want to implicate any real institution. I really I did again a lot of reading. I heard a lot about institutions at that time, and I think it's, you know, what the description is not far-fetched, but I also didn't know anything about specific institutions, so I'm sorry if that was frustrating. It wasn't real. Yeah. Well, you've been just a wonderful audience. If there are more questions, I'll answer them, but if not, I'd be happy to talk one-on-one if you feel more comfortable doing that, and I don't know if there are books to sign. Thank you.